Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week, meditation instructor Marcus Casey continues our study of the book Cultivating True Compassion by Trungpa Rinpoche, covering the chapter which focuses on the Bodhisattva vow. Our high ideals in wanting to live a life of love and compassion are tested when we take the Bodhisattva vow, in which we promise to watch for and diminish selfish fixation in all aspects of our lives. In this chapter, Trungpa Rinpoche discusses the vow, how we take it, and how we maintain it. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Good morning. Welcome. I'm glad to see you all here. Thank you for making your way to Columbus KTC. My name is Marcus Casey, and I'm one of the volunteer meditation instructors here at KTC. And when Lama Kathy and Lama Tom are away, we have volunteer meditation instructors fill in and go through a book for a book study. Currently, our book is by Trungpa Rinpoche, who is one of His Holiness Karmapa's teachers. And the name of the book is Cultivating True Compassion, Bodhicitta and the Bodhisattva Vow. I have a digital copy, so I don't have one I can hold up and show to you, but it's available digitally or in paper. I think you can find it on Amazon or from our bookstore at our home monastery in New York. The name of the bookstore is Namze Bangzo, but KTD is the name of the monastery. So today we're going to be talking about the Bodhisattva vow, and it is the vow to follow the Mahayana path. There may be some of you in the room who have taken the vow, some of you in the room who are thinking of taking the vow, or some of you who are just hearing about it for the first time. Our center, Columbus KTC, KTC stands for Karma Triyana Dharma Chakra. Sorry, that's the name of KTD. Karma Teksum Choling, that's in here too. So the Teksum, the T in KTC and the T in KTD mean the same thing. In KTC, it's the Tibetan word, and in KTD, Triyana, it's the Sanskrit word. But it means the same thing. And Triyana, is the Sanskrit one, means three, tri, and yanas, three yanas, the three vehicles. And those are Hinayana, Mahayana, and Vajrayana. So when the three vehicles, Hinayana, is known as the small vehicle, when people first come to the Dharma, when they first come to the teachings, they are searching for something. They may have an intuitive feeling that there's something more, some potential of our minds that we haven't grasped yet. So there's a curiosity, and people begin to study and learn and try to make sense of the idea of awakening and the idea that we can move beyond suffering. Many people come because there's dissatisfaction and suffering, and they know that the Buddhist path is about training our minds to move beyond suffering. And so this is where many of us start. And this is the perfect launching point. You come, you hear the teachings, and you may take refuge at that point. But what we're talking about there is the small boat, the small vehicle. And what that means is, if you imagine that you're crossing an ocean to get to enlightenment, and when you're first starting out, you're really in a boat built for one. And you're looking for your own way out of suffering, your own way to realize your own potential and awakening. What we're going to be talking about today is the Mahayana. And Maha means big or great. It's the big boat. And basically, it's the boat that says, I'm going to reach enlightenment for the sake of all beings, for the sake of the suffering that I see around me in everyone, not just my own personal suffering. So it is really a shift in motivation when you as you grow in the path and you start to realize that this what you're aiming at, this enlightenment or awakening that you're aiming at, is not just something that can take away your own suffering. It is something that can make a tremendous change in all beings. So today's talk is about the ceremony that puts us formally in that big boat. And it's the beginning of our path formally as a bodhisattva, as someone seeking enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. And this is the step we take to formally become bodhisattvas in training. Now, when we start our talks, we traditionally say the four-line refuge prayer at the beginning. The prayer is in Tibetan, so some of you may know it, some of you may not. If you know it, if you don't know it, feel free to just listen and make the aspiration that you will awaken and help others to awaken. This actually is a short four-line prayer that is a prayer of both refuge and bodhicitta. So it is a prayer to go for refuge, which we'll talk about a little later, and to train in the virtues of a bodhisattva. So when we're chanting this, we're repeating our commitment to take refuge in the three jewels, which are the Buddha, or the goal, what we aspire to become, the Dharma, which is the path, and the Sangha, or the guides or companions on the path. We'll chant the prayer three times. Sangye chidang sogi chognam la jang chu bardu dai ni kap su chi dagi jin sogi pe su nang gi dro la pen chir sangye du par sho Sangye chidang sogi chognam la jang chu bardu dai ni kap su chi dagi jin sogi pe su nang gi dro la pen chir sangye du par sho Sangye chidang sogi chognam la jang chu bardu dai ni kyab su chi dagi jin sogi pe su nang gi dro la pen chir sangye du par sho. So first, let's define terms a little bit, in case some of these terms are unfamiliar for you. We'll be talking a lot about bodhicitta. And bodhicitta is the compassionate wish to attain enlightenment for the sake of all beings. And a bodhisattva is someone who has aroused bodhicitta. And in the context of what we're talking about today, a bodhisattva is also someone who is taking the vow or has taken the vow and become what Lama Kathy calls a bodhisattva in training. So there are two types in the book. In some of the previous chapters, we've talked about the two types of bodhicitta. There is aspiration bodhicitta, and there is action bodhicitta. Now, this book, The Way of the Bodhisattva, is one of the preeminent texts that we use. Was written in 700-800s, something like that, by an Indian monk named Shantideva. And he talks all about bodhicitta and the bodhisattva path. And when he talks about the difference between the two types of bodhicitta, he says, as corresponding to the wish to go and then to setting out. So we may not be ready yet for unceasing active bodhicitta. So we start with the aspiration. We start building that motivation and generating the compassion required to reorient our entire motivation toward all beings. So the generation of aspiration bodhicitta is formalized by taking the bodhisattva vow. Generating bodhicitta and taking the bodhisattva vow produce tremendous virtue. So Trungpa Rinpoche in the chapter today, he talks about how he talks a lot about merit or virtue that we it's difficult. You have to choose your words carefully when you talk about this. It's basically, well, the Buddha taught that positive circumstances arise as a result of virtuous deeds, right? Virtuous deeds lead to positive states of mind. They lead to positive outcomes. And non-virtuous deeds likewise lead to non-virtuous states of mind and outcomes. So when we talk about virtue and merit, what we're really talking about is the habits, the way we train our minds, the habits that we instill in our minds as a result of our virtuous activity. And what Trungpa Rinpoche says is that some types of virtue operate differently than other types of virtue. And what he's specifically referring to is virtue done with a motivation of bodhicitta versus virtue that's done with other motivations. He says that other virtue is like a banana tree, because once a stalk of a banana tree has produced fruit, it will never produce fruit again. All virtue is good, but virtue that is not motivated by bodhicitta will lead to merit and positive circumstances, but once that has arisen, it basically has exhausted itself. You've gotten the result of the action, and that's the end of it. However, bodhicitta is like a tree that bears fruit and is not exhausted. It continues to grow and produce more fruit every year. Even when positive circumstances arise as a result of practicing the virtue, it's not done. It's not, we practiced the virtue, we got the result, and then it's done. Bodhicitta really has a compounding effect, and the root virtue itself continues to grow and amass until we attain Buddhahood. Rinpoche says the reason that bodhicitta operates differently than other virtues is that the fundamental intention or motivation is different. In the case of bodhicitta, our intention is to continue to engage in the deeds of a bodhisattva until we attain Buddhahood and until all of samsara has been emptied, no matter how many innumerable beings there are and how many innumerable eons that will require. Rinpoche says, your intention governs the way in which it ripens. So, just as a pause there, there was a pretty heavy statement in that, wasn't there? This vow is a vow not just for this lifetime. This vow is a vow not just until you reach Buddhahood. This vow isn't a vow for my own motivation from now until I reach Buddhahood and until all beings reach Buddhahood, no matter how long that takes. So this really does require a fundamental belief that there's almost nothing else worthwhile than working for your own awakening and the awakening of others. Because if you don't have that single-pointed focus, if you don't readjust to that, it may be that today you feel, yeah, this sounds great. But if it's an emotional decision, there may be something else that comes along that kind of steals away your intention. This is basically saying that that you've come to understand that there's nothing else that will make you or anyone else happy like bodhicitta. And therefore, it is worth pursuing until it has reached every last being caught in suffering. Now, Rinpoche talks about a vow of individual liberation and says that it also, just like the virtue is different, the vow is different from the bodhisattva vow. He says that we talk a lot about body, speech, and mind here. So he says that a vow of individual liberation is mostly centered around the body and the speech. And as such, a lot of it's about behavior, and it is easier to keep, but he also says it's harder to repair. On the other hand, the bodhisattva vow is harder to keep, but it's easier to repair. It's harder to keep because it's a vow of the mind. It's a vow of motivation. It's not just centered around behavior. It's a vow of motivation. So it's a vow that you can have the right motivation in one thought and the wrong motivation in the very next thought. And so from thought to thought, you can actually break that vow. And so it's actually important and common to revisit this vow on a daily basis. So people who take this vow often repeat this vow daily to continue to reorient and get back to the importance of this vow. And that's part of the training we do to train our minds to keep that motivation always front and center. So Rinpoche says that every time we retake the vow, we strengthen our mindfulness and awareness and gradually improve our maintenance of bodhicitta. So to dive into that a little bit, mindfulness. When you have a vow that depends on motivation, when it's a vow of the mind, when it's a vow that can be broken from thought to thought, mindfulness is extremely important, right? Having the mindfulness to keep the thoughts under the close watch of what we call the other one, he says, awareness. So awareness is that watcher that watches, and mindfulness is the part of our minds that we train to be steady. So if you're talking about keeping a motivation from thought to thought to thought, you go back to it, you keep practicing it, so that slowly you build that watcher so that you're always on guard and you always notice as your mind starts to drift and you start to have motivations that are other than altruistic motivations. So the rest of the chapter then Trungpa Rinpoche talks about the ceremony itself. Now, this is a ceremony that, Lama Kathy gives from time to time. So it is a ceremony you can take here. And if you're interested in taking it, I would say you should talk to Lama Kathy about sometime so that she can get it on the calendar and let everyone know so that anyone who wants to take it can. The ceremony has three parts. The preliminary is refuge. Then there's the main body, which is the taking of the Bodhisattva vow itself. And then there's the conclusion, which is rejoicing. So before we go for refuge, in both the ceremony and often in our own practices, we perform three prostrations. Now, Rinpoche says that when we perform prostrations, we are performing an activity that is a remedy for the affliction of pride. We touch our knees, palms, and foreheads on the ground to acknowledge that all of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas have fully developed qualities that we do not yet possess. We wish to emulate these Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, which is why we go to them for refuge. So the meaning of the prostrations is the humility before that which we wish to emulate. So often newcomers have a lot of questions about what we have on our shrine and about what those represent. They're also coming from a context of often familiarity with other religions in which there's the idea of worship or something like that. This is a little different. When we prostrate before our shrine, we are basically saying that our shrine represents the potential that we also have, the potential within us that we have not yet realized. And we are performing an act of humility before that as a way to tune in to that potential and begin to arouse that same potential within us. So once we've finished the prostrations in the ceremony, we go into the refuge portion. Now, when we take the Bodhisattva vow, we're taking the vow in front of the same Buddhas and Bodhisattvas that we take refuge in. And in the ceremony, we do a visualization. We visualize the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas in front of us, like masses of clouds. The idea in a culture like ours that isn't familiar with this, that doesn't do this a lot, visualization can, and the idea of visualization can kind of bring up a lot of doubts in people. We find ourselves thinking, but they're not really there. Why are we pretending they're there, right? Why should I imagine this? And Rinpoche says that it's true that we can't actually observe their physical presence, but we believe that waking up actually causes a fundamental shift in the way that a being interacts with what we call reality. Rinpoche says that the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas have stainless wisdom. They are able to observe us easily and clearly, as if we were placed in the palms of their hands. From their point of view, it is exactly the same as if they were right in front of us, observing what we are doing. So while we may have trouble believing that they're actually there, Rinpoche is saying that just because we can't see or hear them, if we supplicate them, when we call them to witness, they hear us and bestow their blessings on us. Visualizing them is an acknowledgement of their wisdom and presence. As an aside, that's what we're aspiring to as well. We're aspiring to reach a state in which we are no longer nearly as constrained by the limitations that we currently have in benefiting beings. Currently, we're limited by time and space and understanding and our lack of wisdom and many other things by how we can assist beings with what they need. Whereas what we're saying is there is actually a state where we will have one day stainless wisdom. And when people are in need and call, we can help. And it's a bit of a leap for us to think about that. But that's basically what we're saying. We're saying there are people who have started just where we are and have accomplished that. And now we can call them in front of us and we can make a vow to them to do the same and receive their blessings. So most of the time, and maybe all of the time, in order to take the bodhisattva, we will have already taken refuge. And taking refuge is the formal entrance into the path of Buddhism. What does taking refuge mean? Just like what it sounds. If we get caught in a storm, we might duck into a building to take refuge from the storm. In other words, we're looking for shelter or protection. And what are we looking for shelter or protection from when we take refuge in the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas? We are taking refuge from our ignorance, our self-clinging, and the suffering that these cause. The historical Buddha said, "I teach of suffering and the end of suffering." So in Buddhism, we're trying to decrease our own suffering and the suffering of others. Or looking at the other side of the coin, we're looking to increase our own happiness and the happiness of others. And as Buddhists, we do this by following the path of spiritual growth and transformation taught by the Buddha. Now, we often think about taking refuge as something special. But when you really think about it, we're taking refuge all the time. We take refuge in things like our intimate relationships, our homes, our jobs, entertainment. I was thinking today, what do you take refuge in when you're bored? What do you do when you're bored? Your phone. There you go. For most of us, that's what it is now. 10 years ago, it wasn't, but now that's literally what it is. Because we feel like when we're bored, there's that little nagging suffering that's going on, right? And we need to take refuge in something for it. So what we do when we take refuge is we're just reorienting a natural tendency. We have a natural tendency when we feel dissatisfied or suffering to take refuge. And we're reorienting that in a way that reflects our wisdom, reflects the understanding we've come to that that everything else that we would take refuge in is temporary, it's impermanent, and will one day let us down. When I teach the intro classes, I give when I'm talking about that, I give a statement that one of the meditation instructors here uses from time to time. He says, you know, when you think about it, every marriage ends in divorce or death. And death's actually the preferred one, right? Everything will let us down. But there is, in the Dharma and the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, something that will not, that will continue. And so that's why we take refuge from this world of constant change, impermanence, and suffering. That's why we take refuge in the Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas, and the Dharma. So Rinpoche here distinguishes between the refuge vow that you would have taken already in order to move on to the Bodhisattva vow by saying that the initial refuge vow that we took was the vow of the small vehicle, the Hinayana vow. It was the vow to move toward enlightenment, because we've realized our own suffering, and we've realized that currently we're taking refuge in things that will let us down and lead to suffering. But he says this vow of refuge is the Mahayana vow of refuge. And as part of this ceremony, we are taking this vow not just for this lifetime. It is a vow from now until we attain full Buddhahood. In the Mahayana vow of refuge, he said, you're not just concerned with freeing yourself from suffering. It is an altruistic vow to bring all beings along with you. So when you actually take the vow, there is a pose that you get into that's a very traditional pose. It is said this is the pose that the Buddha's disciples used when they spoke to him or when he was addressing them. And you basically get on your right knee and you kneel to take the vow. So right knee, palms joined in an attitude of supplication in front of your heart. And you perform the vow three times. And after you've performed the vow three times, the Lama snaps his or her fingers, at which time you have received the vow, the Mahayana vow of refuge. So the vow itself, the words we use for the Bodhisattva vow actually come from this book, chapter 3 of this book. And Rinpoche says that this vow has a section for both aspiration bodhicitta and action bodhicitta. So the verses for aspiration bodhicitta go like this. Just as all the previous Shugatas, the Buddhas, generated the mind of enlightenment and accomplished all the stages of the Bodhisattva training, so will I too, for the sake of all beings, generate the mind of enlightenment and accomplish all the stages of the Bodhisattva training. And then it moves into the action section. Just as they have trained in all the stages of a Bodhisattva, I will engage or train in those same stages. And so you repeat those three times, and then the Lama snaps her fingers, sealing the vow. And then you move on to the section of rejoicing. The final part is rejoicing, and it has two parts: rejoicing in having generated bodhicitta and inviting others to rejoice in this as well. So this is also in here. We are taking a vow for as long as it takes to attain Buddhahood. We need to constantly accumulate merit. We need to develop an attitude of joy for our generation of bodhicitta. So this is basically stepping back and realizing what a monumental thing this is that we have done and rejoicing in it. And when we repeat this on a daily basis, to repeat this rejoicing part as well, to rejoice in our bodhisattva motivation on a daily basis. And Rinpoche says that when we rejoice in something, we reinforce that activity. And what we're rejoicing in is the path that we have started. Innumerable Buddhas and Bodhisattvas have appeared throughout time, and all of them started just like we are, as ordinary sentient beings who began generating bodhicitta. They trained gradually, and they attained enlightenment. And the only reason we haven't yet is because we're just now getting started. We're just now generating bodhicitta and getting started. But how fantastic is that? In this very lifetime, at this moment, we are making that vow, and now it's time to rejoice in what we've done. So it may seem like a small thing now, but it will lead to great things. And if we are diligent, we will end our suffering and be of tremendous benefit to innumerable beings. So the participants in the ceremony then say, "Today my life is fruitful. I have obtained a precious human existence and am born into the family of the Buddha. Now I am a child of the Buddha." And then once we have rejoiced, then we invite others to rejoice with us. Just an aside here. Lama Kathy has taught that there is great virtue in rejoicing in the virtue of others. We're limited in what we can do. When we see someone doing a great thing or a small thing that makes a difference in someone's life, we participate in that. We build on that by simply taking a moment to rejoice in what they have done. So we're inviting others to rejoice in what we have just done in taking the vow. And it says, innumerable beings without exception. Rinpoche says, all of those beings who are looking for a friend, looking for someone to help them become happy and someone to protect them from sadness, we are taking this bodhisattva vow as a promise to be that friend and to train ourselves so that we can better be that friend. So in the ceremony we say, all of you rejoice, do not despair, because today I have taken on the responsibility for establishing each and every one of you in a state of full liberation and happiness. The closing of the ceremony then includes three aspirations. The aspirations are, and this again is in here, may all those beings who have not yet generated bodhicitta generate bodhicitta. May all those beings who have generated bodhicitta never allow it to become impaired. May all those who have generated bodhicitta and maintained it free from impairment cause it to increase so that they finally attain Buddhahood. We've talked a lot about generating bodhicitta. Shantideva says about bodhicitta in chapter 1 in this book, he says, virtue thus is weak, and always evil is of great and overwhelming strength. Except for perfect bodhicitta, what other virtue is there that can lay it low? And what he's saying is that the commitment to all beings is really the only virtue we have that can ultimately overcome evil, can overcome negativity in this world. And what we're talking about here is impartial love. There is no bodhicitta that excludes someone. Bodhicitta is by definition universal. It is not love that is based on how much that being deserves that love in your view. It's not love that's based on how close that person is to you in your life. It is compassion, and it is a commitment to end the suffering of all beings without exception. It's pretty easy to think about people who would be first on our list if we were allowed exceptions, right? And so when that's an easy thing to bring to mind, that's actually, there are trainings we use that in which we do bring those people to mind specifically to make sure that our bodhicitta is not a limited, or our as we generate bodhicitta, make sure we're not generating a limited compassion, but a universal compassion. We generate bodhicitta through diligence and practice with constant rejoicing. Now, there are a few verses then I'll read from chapter 3 here, where we find the Bodhisattva vow. And then I'll close and we'll have time for some questions. Shantideva says, "For all those ailing in the world, until their every sickness has been healed, may I myself become for them the doctor, nurse, the medicine itself. Raining down a flood of food and drink, may I dispel the ills of thirst and famine. And in the eons marked by scarcity and want, may I myself appear as drink and sustenance. For sentient beings, poor and destitute, may I become a treasure ever plentiful and lie before them closely in their reach, a varied source of all that they may need. My body thus, and all my goods besides, and all my merits gained and to be gained, I give them all, and do not count the cost, to bring about the benefit of beings. And so let beings do to me whatever does not bring them injury. Whenever they may think of me, let this not fail to bring them benefit. And if in my regard they have a thought of anger or respect, may these states always be the cause whereby their good and wishes are fulfilled. All those who slight me to my face or do to me some other evil, even if they blame or slander me, may they attain the fortune of enlightenment. May I be a guard for those who are protectorless, a guide for those who journey on the road. For those who wish to cross the water, may I be a boat, a raft, a bridge. May I be an isle for those who yearn for land, a lamp for those who long for light, for all who need a resting place, a bed. For those who need a servant, may I be their slave. May I be the wishing jewel, the vase of wealth, a word of power and the supreme healing. May I be the tree of miracles, for every being the abundant cow. Just like the earth and space itself and all the other mighty elements, for boundless multitudes of beings, may I always be the ground of life, the source of varied sustenance. Thus, for everything that lives, as far as the limits of the sky, may I be constantly their source of livelihood until they pass beyond all sorrow." And that's the section that precedes the Bodhisattva vow in this text. I actually had the good fortune to attend a retreat at KTD a few years ago, and one of the monks at KTD, who is actually he's the retreat master, helps with the retreatants, the 3-year retreatants. And he leads some retreats himself at KTD that are open to the public. You'll always see him walking with a prayer wheel. Always has a prayer wheel in his hand, which I don't know if you guys are familiar with the concept of a prayer wheel, but basically he has mantras in that prayer wheel, so that even though himself he's limited, he's got literally millions of mantras printed on tiny, these days they use technology, older technology, but microfiche, I think it is, millions of mantras printed on there, and he's constantly spinning it as a way to constantly generate virtue. In this retreat, he focused a lot on generating bodhicitta and generating compassion for beings and setting our motivation before we did the practice that he was actually teaching. And it was one of the most profound experiences of my life as he guided us through meditations that were heart-wrenching, actually. He would talk about individual animals and what their lives were like, what their life cycle was like, and the pain and misery that they went through. He would talk about people in certain circumstances and how difficult that was. And he really spent a lot of time going through that activity. And you could tell this was something he does regularly and is very close to his mind at all times. And we spent so much time setting our motivation that when we finally did the practice, that we were there to learn. It was far more powerful than if we hadn't set our motivation correctly. And this is what the Bodhisattva vow is for, and this is what it's about. It's basically to reorient our motivation to all suffering beings. And for those who are interested in taking it, I highly recommend it. And for those who have taken it, maintain it. Repeat it daily. Take it over and over. So that's all I have prepared. We have the microphone available. If anyone wants to ask questions, feel free.
Hi.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I can hear you. Simon.
Simon.
I aspire to this vow.
Mm-hmm.
But I confess that I find it almost too idealistic.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a biologist.
Mm-hmm.
And you spoke a little bit about the animals.
Mm-hmm.
And I find it complicating to aspire to end suffering when I see it as a natural state in the natural world. I don't want to rain on this parade.
No.
It's just a troubling place I find myself in, and perhaps you could offer something in that way.
Sure.
Along those lines. Thank you.
So I'll try. The premise that suffering is a natural state is actually a realization that the Buddha himself came to. The Buddha, in his life story, he was raised as a prince, and the story goes that there had been a prophecy that the Buddha would either become a great ruler of his father's kingdom, or would become a great spiritual teacher. And his father wanted him to rule his kingdom. And so he kept him totally happy with every material thing. Guarded him from seeing the suffering that was actually happening in the world. But at some point he became dissatisfied, and he snuck out of and he got in amongst the people. And for the first time, he was exposed to suffering, old age, and death. And you're right, those are all inevitable. And so from that, he went on a journey to search, to discover if there was actually something beyond that, if there was actually a release from suffering. And he found it, and that was his profound awakening. And when he first taught, after coming to that realization, he taught the Four Noble Truths, and he taught what you're talking about. The first noble truth is exactly what you're talking about, that the truth of suffering, that suffering is pervasive, It is the pervasive state of all of us. But that there is a way out of that suffering, and there's a cause to that suffering. And the cause to that suffering is our own clinging to ourselves, our own ego fixation. And the way out of that is to remove that ego clinging and that fixation. And to do so, he set forth a path, the Eightfold Path of how to do that. And the meditation practices we teach are part of that path. The idea is that we suffer because things are always changing and we don't want them to, or things are as we don't want them to be and we want them to change and they're not changing when we want them to. So the idea is that the suffering doesn't actually come from our circumstances. It comes from our clinging. In this lifetime, even if we are able to let go of that clinging, we will still have those same circumstances. We'll still have that pain. But we don't have to participate in the suffering that is so naturally follows from that for us. As to the suffering of animals, animals in most cases don't have the capacity for what we've talked about today, for bodhicitta, for generating bodhicitta. But we don't see the animals really as any different than ourselves. We see animals as one more temporary state of suffering that we ourselves are also caught in. We believe that we are fortunate to have a human birth, and beyond that, to have a human birth at a time and in a place where our material needs are met, and beyond that, to actually be born in a time and a place when we can and have received the teachings of the Dharma. The sliver of humanity to whom all of those conditions applies is minuscule. The sliver of all beings to whom that applies is even smaller than that. And we use that as a motivation to make use of it. And the idea is that we make use of this fantastic opportunity we have been given. And then we can further influence others. We have the benefit of the teachings from those who have come before. And I think you can actually think of it as at some point there may be a tipping point. There's a growing number. And we add to that, and we add to that, and we add to that. And the beings who are stuck in that cycle of suffering, whether in a state of being an animal or a human or any other states they may be, will gradually decrease and the number of beings who can help gradually increase. But the enormity of what we are taking on is not lost on us. From another tradition, there is a version of the vow that says the number of beings is innumerable. I vow to liberate them all. The mechanics of how that will happen is less our concern, as it is that when we're generating compassion on that massive a scale, the virtue it produces, the We're getting something rolling, the impetus or the, I mean, the momentum, thank you, that's the word I'm looking for, the momentum that we're building there for achieving enlightenment can't be underestimated. And it's almost, that momentum is big in the sense of how many beings we've incorporated into our vow. So that innumerable beings, the idea, is also what gives power to the unbelievable virtue that we are generating. Hope that helps. Any other questions? All right. Let's dedicate the virtue of listening to this talk and this teaching by Trungpa Rinpoche. Let's dedicate that to all beings, that we and all beings will one day awaken and move beyond suffering, the suffering that is so immediate and so obvious and so pervasive in this world, that we may all wake up and assist others in doing so. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.